Bill, everybody. Bill, go ahead, my friend.
Very good. Good day to everyone. I know the different time zones and all that, but it's just gone 7 o'clock here in Dublin, or in Wexford. My name is Bill. I'm an alcoholic. How do I say? I'm a recovered alcoholic. I like to say that. Not out of any kind of sense of pride, but just out of a sense of gratitude, because I do rather enjoy recovery. And I wouldn't like whatever powers there might be out there to think I wasn't appreciative of it. I am very appreciative of it. I started drinking back in when I just after I left what would be high school in America, but I was about 18 years of age. And the alcoholic drinking really kicked off almost immediately. It was the first time I felt content with myself when I had drink taken. As soon as I had a few drinks in, I kind of felt the way I didn't feel under normal circumstances. I was, I don't know what way I was really, but I was funny sort of a young fella, funny growing up, and not very happy in myself. So the drink was a huge sort of breakthrough. I sort of, wow, this is fabulous stuff. I remember the first time I drank and thinking, and this is the kind of foolishness, was that wasn't it wonderful that the government of Ireland had organized it so that there were pubs not only in every town, but practically on every street in every town in Ireland. And you could go into any of them and you could get to feel like this. It was almost, I was quite, I really was very taken with the effect of drink right at the very start. And it wasn't a social thing. It wasn't because I was happy laughing with other people or anything like that. It was the effect of drink that it had on me. So from the age of 18, I pretty well got stuck in. And everything I did, any of the sort of usual things people did in that age and for the next 5 or 6 years were done on the basis of how close would that bring me to drink, not for any other reason. I joined a football club in Dublin, but it was a football club that in those days was almost unique. It had a bar, and it was a place where you could drink, and there were lots of other people drinking. It wasn't just the people who played football. There were other sports involved there as well. And the bar was always busy, and I loved it. I joined a drama group, but it was a drama group, and it was a very good one. But my main was that, again, there were seemed to be very committed drinkers in the group. I don't know whether that's general about drama groups, but it certainly was my focus. And I got married. I took up with a girl who, I suppose, one of the most relaxing things about her was that her family were very easygoing about drinking and about drinking quite a bit. So all my focus at the time was really on drinking. I mean, there are other elements to it, but just to give you an idea of that. And then I drank in a pub where, allegedly it was the best pint in Ireland, and that was important. I thought that the drink that you drank was really, really high quality stuff. But again, the reality was that the people who drank there were mostly alcoholic, and I don't say that lightly. They genuinely were. The pub was the most decrepit place you could imagine in Dublin, and I don't think there was a ladies' bathroom. It was quite horrible. And I remember bringing people to it and saying, "Isn't this a wonderful pub? Isn't this brilliant?" And people would look at you, sort of, it's a dump and it's horrible. What are you doing living here? What are you doing drinking here? But I thought it was just wonderful. And that was another aspect of the focus on nothing threatening or drinking. I had money. I had a very, I soon got a very good job, and there was plenty of money. unusually in those days. And I didn't want to associate with golf club people or with people who, wore sweaters with little crocodiles on them or anything like that. I was, to me, they were a threat. They were kind of ordinary people who had other things in life, and I didn't want any other things in life. Again, I recall I bought a house when my wife and I were getting married. We bought a house, and I remember going in for an interview. At that time, the builder would interview you for your loan, quite different than from today. But I remember listening at in the waiting room, and there was a guy who went in front of me, and he had arrived in a little sports car with his wife. And when he was talking, I could hear the conversation, and I remember him saying his salary at the time was about, it was a little bit more than half of mine, but that's what it was, about half of mine. But I'd come on the bus. I didn't think affording a car was a good idea. I mean, that meant directing money away from my drinking, and everything I had went for it. So that was what my drinking was like. And it went on after I got married, we had a few children, a couple of children. But I was still making good money, and my wife was making good money as well. So we were able to function and kind of keep up. We'd a nice house, and we'd, all that. I mean, it was the worst garden in the whole estate, because of course I would start digging it and then, give up and like come back to it 6 months later when the nettles were growing quite well. And everybody else had lovely lawns and trees and things like that. And mine was just a disaster, but I didn't see any of that. I really didn't see it. I remember one time again being sent off by my co the company I worked for, sent off to the Middle East to do some work out there, and it was quite important work. But of course, and being the Middle East, I thought, well, there's going to be very little drink out there, the country I'm going to. But in fact, there was plenty of drink, and I found it very quickly. But at one stage, my wife in Dublin sent me out a photograph of herself. She'd had a photographer in. And she sent a photograph of herself and the two children. And I actually wrote back to her, asking her who was the second child. I didn't recognize the child. Now, it was a perfectly reasonable likeness of my daughter, but I didn't actually recognize her. And that will give you the idea of just how detached I was from any normal sort of thing that a 28, 29-year-old person to be thinking about. I was just really bad. And I thought everything was okay. There was money. I didn't have to borrow any money. There was always food on the table and all that sort of thing. But the house was a disaster. The problem with alcoholics, in my experience, my father was an alcoholic, and the problem, on reflection, years and years later, thinking about it, the problem is not so much what the alcoholic parent does, it's what the alcoholic parent doesn't do by way of rearing. Like my father would never come to a football match where I was playing. He never took any active part in my upbringing. He never did anything really except, sit there and kind of quiet, and then he'd break out every now and again, and he'd go on the drink, and he'd complain about the job he had, which was the softest job probably in Ireland at the time. But part of the reason, I suppose, that I took to the drink so early when I was 18 or so, and it made me feel so good, was I'd nothing else to go on. I hadn't got any of those normal upbringing things that kids get from parents who aren't alcoholic. I just didn't get it. And I thought not getting it was normal. I didn't realize that other kids did have it and felt better and felt more about themselves than I did because of that. It's a curious sort of thing, you know. But having, I've realized all that now in recent years. But the fact is that I repeated that behavior with my own children. You know, I really did. I recall one time I was in the pub and I was interrupted by this very angry man who came in, and he said, "What are you thinking of?" Because I'd locked my child in the car park outside the pub. And I thought that was okay behavior. I didn't, you know, it's pretty awful for me to think about it even today, though I must say I have a very good relationship with my children today, thankfully. But that's the way it was then. I didn't really fall into ill health. I stopped drinking when I was 33. And I'd got into some sort of really, I suppose it must have been a depression. I don't know what it was, but I'd fallen into a kind of a stupor. And I sat at home, I remember, for a week or more. And of course, the job, I forgot to say about the job. The job, even though, as I say, I was extremely good at what I did, and sought after. But like, I didn't give a shit about that either. You know, I cared about nothing. I just thought I was brilliant and they were lucky to have me. And I, of course, I wasn't that brilliant. I was brilliant enough, but I wasn't that, you know, I was good. But like, I'd be at a business meeting, a board meeting in the job, and it was a big company, and I'd be going over some sort of project that I was going to run, you know, and there were very good ideas for projects and very good. Some of them were very successful, but I recall one time I left the business meeting. I mean, the managing director of the company was there. There was chief accountants and all these guys, and I left the meeting to go to the bathroom. And when I was in the bathroom, I decided I'm not going back. I'm just going to go out to the pub. That was the kind of irresponsible. And like, they were on to the house to see where I was. They were getting the police and all this because they thought I was after dying or something, you know. But that never dawned on me. None of that, the disturbance of other people, never occurred to me. You know, there's a story in the big book about the guy who keeps jumping under cars. Anytime he goes out, he jumps under cars or street cars or fire engines, you know. And like, it's an example of alcoholic behavior in the sense that he didn't give a shit about the effect it had on the drivers. Or the effect it might have on a fire engine going to a fire and the people in the house who may be burning to death. He never gave any thought to any of this stuff. He just wanted to jump out in front of a fire engine, and so he did. And that's the way I was. I can readily identify with that guy, in his lack of concern for anyone else. And that's what my drinking was like. So, as I say, at the age of 33, I was brought to an AA meeting. I didn't know what AA was. I thought it was some sort of religious political organization in Ireland, something like the Knights of Colin Bannis or something. And I had no idea what it was. But at the very first meeting, I saw a man that I thought he would be a great guy to drink with and swap stories. And he looked to me like a really good drinker, you know. And that was the attraction. I asked him when the next meeting was, and he said it was on a Friday in Dublin and down in Merrion Square. And I went to that meeting, and I haven't had a drink since. And that sounds brilliant. I mean, it was for the first 6 months or so. You know, when people say, "If you only stop drinking, you'd be grand. If you only stop drinking, you'd be grand," and that's true up to a point, but it's also not true. Because all the things that I was when I was in my teens all came back. I thought then I was going to mature in the way that an 18-year-old going on a journey onto being 23 or 4 would mature during that period. I thought I was going to mature, but I didn't. And I remember there was a graph or a curve in a lot of these hospitals or treatment centers where you'd go to meetings and it would describe your alcoholism on a downward curve, and then there was a flat bit, and then there was an upward part where you felt better and you got better and things happened. And that upward curve never happened for me. I mean, I knew I was powerless over alcohol. And I didn't think my life was unmanageable. I thought once you stop drinking, you got the manageability back in your life. And of course, I've learned since that that's not the case. So, but I went along. I did a lot of service in AA. I went to meetings rigorously. I mean, there were weekends when, there'd be some appalling event in the house, and I would go to three meetings on the Saturday and three meetings on the Sunday. And even though, my wife was in tears or my children were in tears or whatever it was, I would come home on a Sunday night and say, well, I didn't drink over it, So I still had this terrible self-centeredness and selfishness going on. Then I thought, well, maybe it's not AA. Maybe I should go to Al-Anon, or maybe I should go because of my father, or adult children of alcoholics, or whatever, And I mean, to give you an idea, I actually one time went to university. I was in Canada, living in Canada at the time, and I went to university and I did a degree in psychology on the basis that this would explain what was wrong with me, that I wasn't, really reaping the benefits that other people seem to be reaping, And of course, the problem was underlying it all was I wasn't on the program. I had the first part of the first step, and that's all I had. After I lived in Canada, I remember I went to France. Myself and my wife were living in, well, we were, yeah, we were kind of living in France, in down in Antibes, and I went to a meeting down there. And it was one of these big book meetings where they read a page of the big book. Now, these were all kind of clever and intelligent people. They weren't fools by any stretch, but they had this really childish approach. They used to, if they read, say, the page, the chapter five, rarely have we seen it. If they read that page, at the end of the page, they would say, how often have we seen a person fail? And we'd all put our hands up and say, rarely have we seen a person fail. It was the height of kind of childishness in a way, but they had a strong thing about sponsorship. And by sponsorship, they meant bringing you through the big book, bringing you through the program, starting at the doctor's opinion and the forewords and all that, and ending up after the family afterwards and the two employers. So did a strong thing about that, and I was going to this. I wasn't, it was an AA meeting. Okay, I'm going to it, and I'm watching this kind of very, what I felt immature kind of behavior. And then my wife, who's in the fellowship, sorry, I got divorced, of course, after all this getting dry, a dry drunk, as my first wife used to call me, and I thought that was a compliment. So give you how foolish I was, but she, but my wife, my present wife, we were living together down there, and she said, "I'm going to get one of the women at the meeting to bring me through the program," and I, of course, like when you're not on the program and you're not drinking, you tend to. I certainly did. I went into the control guy instantly. There's a thing in the big book about the actor and the play, just after, I think, after step three. And it talks about, if only people would do as he says, everything would be fine. And I remember reading that once years ago and said, but that isn't that the way to be? Like, that's how much of a control freak I was. And when my wife said she's going to go, going to talk to this woman or get her to sponsor her, I felt, oh my God, that means she's going to get a whole load of ideas in her head now that I won't be able to, I won't be able to stop or control or anything. So that was quite a horrible person I now was. And she went. And after about 3 weeks, I had this new wife. I didn't know what had happened. It was extraordinary. She just utterly changed. So, being me, I said, "Oh, well, I'll have a bit of that." So I went down to the next meeting and I said, "Will someone bring me through the big book?" And a guy, I was offered this fella, and he took me through it. He lived over in Monaco at the time, and I used to have to drive from Antibes. It was a long old drive over, but I did it, and I kept at it. And my life was utterly transformed. It really was. And it's got better and better and better since then. Today, my family relationships, even my ex-wife, who I, as I say, I treated abominably, I'll meet her on Christmas Day. We'll have dinner together, all that sort of thing. So we're not the best of friends, but we're enough not enemies to actually put up with each other for the day. My grandchildren are in love me, and my children are very fond of me, to say the least of it. We recently, I go away with the grandchildren every year for a little holiday around Halloween, and this year, as I say, we went to Paris. And it was the most successful trip. It really, really was. I mean, the family got on great together. My two of my children and four of my grandchildren and my wife were there, 10 of us, and their husbands rather. And it was phenomenally successful in the way of cementing family relationships, and everybody getting on well, and understanding what each other are all about, and not being afraid of, not being afraid of one's behavior or the other's behavior or the other's reactions. It was really it's the most successful thing. I've done it, as I say, for the last I don't know, 7 or 8 years now. We've gone away with the grandchildren. We've gone away somewhere every year, and I felt I'd made such a bags of of my children, or such an appalling misuse of any kind of parental responsibilities. I felt I this was something I had to do to make amends, and I was able to do it, so I did it. But it's really it's the program. I know today. The 95% to me that people get is the program. And whenever they get the 5% that isn't the program, generally speaking, it doesn't work out all that well. It's hard to describe. But anyway, I'm so proud. I mean, to me, the program is my higher power. The 12 steps are my higher power. I don't have a God. I'm an atheist. I love the idea of being an agnostic. They say the Pope is an agnostic insofar as he's not 100% sure, and I'm probably an agnostic in the sense that I'm not 100% sure either of whether atheism is the correct way to be. But I am an atheist. I don't. I wake up in the morning. My morning prayer is, who can I help today? I had a very good friend in AA a few years back, and he told me that when he'd get onto a sponsor and he'd say, I'm after losing my job and the wife's after leaving me, your man would say, no, but who did you help today? And he'd say, no, you're not listening to me. My wife's after leaving me, and one of my children is sick, and I'm after losing my job. And he'd say, no, but who did you help today? So when I wake up in the morning, I say, who can I help today? And that's my morning prayer. In the evening, I thank my wife for a lovely day if she's around, because generally speaking, the two of us rub along very well together, and a lot of my happiness and my contentment and a lot of the bit of wisdom I have comes through her or through other people that are close to me, So and that's how, I'm open to that now. I'm not, the program has been wonderful, making amends to people. There's one amend I haven't made, and I can't make it. The person is not around, and I've tried to get in touch, and that's the one thing that still kind of haunts me a bit, even though I can't do it. It haunts me, but the rest of the stuff is gone, and I'm perfectly aware of just how sick I was, because when I came to AA, I didn't realize I was mad. I really didn't. I just thought I'd had a bit of trouble with the drink. I didn't realize I was insane. Even though the second step, restores to sanity, I didn't see that. I just didn't see it. I read it, but I didn't see it. But yeah, that's my lot now. I'm just so grateful for what this program has given me. It took me a long time, and it hurt a lot of people that I didn't get it sooner. It hurt a lot of other people. I'm so grateful that I have it today. So that's it. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mark. Thank you, everybody.